Comet.
Howie recognized. Okay, I think you're now discussing, Roy, NEVA's near-vertical interval sky wave, if you know what I mean. Some of that signal goes straight up to the next layer of the ionosphere and bounces back down. And some of it I want to go straight forward to the guy 10 miles away. And now you're saying that those two waves are possibly out of phase and interference is taking place. I'm having trouble with that one because the exact height in number of wavelengths that signal is reflecting off that next ionospheric level above in this near vertical incident sky wave, for that to come down and cancel day after day, the exact same number of wavelengths, half wavelengths, so I can get a cancellation, that's a little bit too lucky as I see it. Some of that is taking place. I just don't feel that that's the dominant factor. I think absorption and heat dissipation in the D layer, the volumetric attenuation, I am guessing is the dominant factor. I could certainly be wrong. Over to you, the guy who just signed in. I'm so forgetful. Go ahead and take it. KQIW.
Okay,
Dick.
Me, Howard, WDK, WW. Two comments. If you're on 80 meters at, say, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, okay, and if you notice the something about 80 meters, 80 meters is worse during the peak of the sunspot cycle. If you're an HF, you would operate 160 and 80 and 40 during the low peaks of the sunspot cycle and tend to go to 20, 15, and 10, and 6. At the high peak of the sunspot cycle. So if you got a band opening, let's say you got a good sunspot cycle, the higher the frequency you go, like up to, up to 10 meters, you're going to have a lower noise floor, lower noise from, natural noise. And I also think that the electrons in the D layer are generating noise. Okay? As you get up to the higher frequencies, your signal's going to bounce, plus the wavelength is shorter. So it acts more like a mirror, at those higher frequencies there. K2RIW, WD2HWW.
Yeah, I like that, Howie. So what I think Howie is saying, at the peak of the sunspot cycle on 80 meters, the amount of signal I get over that 10 mile over the Earth path gets weaker. The peak of the sunspot cycle, there's more solar particles ionizing that D layer there, making it more absorptive. The ionosphere above is more reflective. The higher bands are starting to work better. And the D layer is making more noise. On 80 meters at high noon, the amount of noise coming out of your antenna, I think, could be an S9 on the signal strength meter. So it's a very noisy layer, a very absorptive layer, and the bounce you get off the ionosphere is not good enough to allow you to hear that signal 10 miles away. So I think you're telling me at high noon, 80 meters works better at the low part of the sunspot cycle, and it works worse at the top of the sunspot cycle, is what I think you just said, Roy. I mean, Howie. And so it sort of makes me think that the D layer, more absorptive, more noisy, when it's being hit with more solar particles during the peak of a sunspot cycle. Let's see if Roy agrees or disagrees with that. I'm not sure, as you can tell. AC2GS, K2IW in the TechNet.
AC2GS. I agree entirely. That, I think, is the point of the exercise of this question, is to realize that some people just think that any ionization is good, but D-level ionization tends to be bad. It's not a problem for 40, 20, 15, 17, because it just skirts through it because of the shortened wavelength. But for 160 and 80, it gets bogged down. So in a perfect world, the D level doesn't help anyone. The propagation of 80 meters takes place in the E ionosphere, which is not enormously active during the night, but it still exists. There are background cosmic rays that are innervating the E layer all through the night. So, you know, it's not like all ionization is good. There's good ionization, there's bad ionization, and then there's awful ionization.
Go right ahead, Eric. I'm listening to this. I agree with pretty much all of it. But I think there's another element that's missing here. And in the ionosphere, especially in the D layer, there's the effect of phase change and also the absorption properties of water and oxygen as the molecules get more and more excited. So as you get, like with the CME, you get these very high levels of energy, which causes those molecules to rapidly vibrate. You get these huge phase trip changes, and that's where all the noise comes from, and there's a lot of absorption that goes on, even at really low frequencies. At least that's my recollection of it. Yeah, I'm hearing this for the first time, Paul. I mean, Eric. Are you telling me the water content, the humidity in the atmosphere, the humidity in the D layer, is one of the mechanisms of noise generation at high noon, and the water vapor itself goes through some kind of an ionization process that affects reflectivity, affects absorption? I mean, when it comes to microwave frequencies, the first place where you see real water absorption is at 22 gigahertz. By the way, the microwave oven working at 2.35 gigahertz was a frequency left over. That's how it was chosen. People think that was chosen because it's a frequency where water gets very absorptive. Absolutely not. The water absorbs your microwave energy because the energy is so intense.
Yeah, but you're not talking about the ions being made in the microwave oven or a microwave through the normal atmosphere.
Okay. What is ionizing the water molecules in the D layer at high noon? Run that by again, Eric.
The more energy, be it X-rays, be it cosmic rays, or actually what's coming from the sun in the form of X-rays what I'm thinking is that the ionization factor that goes on when you have a very high disturbance, we're not talking about H2O just being static. We're talking about it being excited and having that effect on it. From what I remember, I really got to go back in my brain, there's something about that. When you spin those molecules rapidly and they're banging into each other, along with oxygen that's in the air, you get this phase shifting effect and some absorption from it. And that's what I'm remembering.
Interesting. The water vapor or the water molecules that are in the D layer at high noon, are we talking about sub-millimeter sized hydrometeors? Are we talking about real, pure water vapor? Which of those is being ionized? And if it was the first, I could see the mechanism of absorption. Real water molecules, you know, very small blobs of water, hydrometeors is another word for it, you know, but weather-like materials, which is what's really going on in a microwave oven. But your pure water vapor, individual water molecules, I don't think they're going to respond that way, but I'm not sure. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
And I'm not trying to pull this out of my hat, but there is something about, just to take Aurora as an example, The Royal ionization creates backscatter. I'm sorry, I'm not being completely verbal about this, but when we're talking about solar flares or CMEs, we're doing a similar kind of thing across the atmosphere of the Earth. It's not coming fast enough, but I remember this being a very positive effect and also phase changes that occur. Give me a few minutes and I'll probably pull it out of my hat.
You might be onto something here, Eric. I'm going to give you a couple of wild pieces of information. At first, they're going to sound disconnected. Another one of the questions that John can ask his people at Los Alamos Laboratory is, what's the average speed of the air molecules that are in the room with him right now at standard temperature and pressure? The air molecules in the room with him right now, what is their average speed? I didn't say velocity, I said speed. Because they go a very short distance, 33 nanometers on average, and strike another air molecule and bounce in some other direction. So they don't have a real vector of direction. That's why it's not called velocity. It's called speed. What is the average speed of the air molecules in the room with you right now? Answer is 500 meters per second, which is what almost 1.5 times the speed of sound is the average speed. And why are they moving that fast? Your thermometer measures average kinetic energy. It's measuring energy, average kinetic energy. Those air molecules, 28 grams is not the right word, but you know what I mean. When you add up the oxygen, nitrogen, and so on, the atomic weight is 28 for air. And to be at the 70 degrees Fahrenheit, it's got to be moving at 500 meters a second to have the right amount of 1/2 MV said energy. Let me drop. I've now got a pool of fresh water in front of me, in my pool. I haven't added any chemistry to it. Water in liquid form. How fast are the water molecules moving? What's their average speed? Not 500 meters per second. You and I picture water molecules as being a very heavy object, and therefore they'd be moving slower. They're moving 640 meters per second. Water in liquid form, average speed of the molecules is 640 meters per second. H2O has only got an atomic weight of 18. Air has an atomic weight of 29. Water is lighter. The individual water molecules, therefore they've got to be moving faster to be at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, so to speak. So water in liquid form, 640 meters per second, round numbers, might be 638.59, you know what I mean, approximately. Now, the individual water molecules, particularly if there's groups of them, they're spinning back and forth, following the electric wave that's nearby in your microwave oven. They're striking each other 8 billion times per second, and each time they strike, and they're spinning at the same time, and it's a slightly bumpy molecule. Let me drop. It's spinning back and forth following the 2.4 gigahertz signal in your microwave oven. So it's this bumpy molecule spinning and striking another molecule. On average, because of the bump, the spin, and the strike, after the bump, they're moving faster than they did before the bump. That's a fancy way of saying they've just absorbed some of the energy of that microwave and they're now at a higher temperature. The food you cook in your microwave oven is being heated by the water molecules that's in your food. You put an extremely dry piece of bread in your microwave oven with a glass of water, and you run it for a minute, the glass of water will be almost boiling, and the dry piece of bread will be ice cold. Same thing with an ice cube, because the water is not present in one case, and it's not free to move in the other case, in the case of the ice cube. Ice cube will stay with absolutely no change. That's why you've got a so-called defrosting cycle in your microwave oven, which very slowly does the heating because the portions of your frozen hamburger that are thawed will absorb the microwave energy. The portions that are frozen do not. And if you try to rapidly cook that hamburger, portions of it will be overcooked and portions of it will be a soggy mess that didn't cook at all. So the defrost cycle very slowly heats the hamburger so that the hot spots slowly get a chance to melt the frozen spots, and then after that you stand a chance of really cooking it in the microwave oven. Cooking frozen food in a microwave oven is very, very troublesome. Let me drop it.
Fast query.
So now we're getting a little bit more of the action at the molecular level of what's happening with hydromedias, water in the D layer. Let's see AC2IS, K2IZ. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Dick. I'm aware that the speed of sound in air varies a lot, noticeably, at least with temperature. So that if you try to sonar echo distance sensing through air, your measurements are, again, noticeably different with cold air versus with warm air. You mentioned something about individual air molecules moving at about 1.5 times the speed of sound. So I'm going to guess that, that the motion of those molecules changes when it heats up or cools down, so that stays true. In water, you mentioned heating up water, and I'm wondering if the same holds true. I'm thinking maybe not, because I think the density of air changes a lot with temperature. I'm thinking the density of water does not change much with temperature, so probably the speed of sound doesn't change so much, but certainly the average speed of the molecules should, right, with temperature. So maybe this is not the same kind of thing going on where water molecules travel about 1.5 times the speed of sound in water. I think the speed of sound in water is higher. Speed of sound in water, I think, is faster. But maybe you can comment on this. Does the speed of sound in water change with the temperature of the water? AC2IS.
Very much so. First of all, you said something, but you didn't tell us the direction. Hotter air moves faster. Hotter air, the speed of sound, is faster. When you look at the speed of sound versus temperature of the air, it's primarily a function of the temperature of the air, not the pressure. You can take high pressure air and low pressure air at the same temperature. The speed of sound in the two is kind of close. Whereas you take hot air and cold air, the speed of sound is very different, much faster in the hot air. The speed of sound in water changes very much as a function of temperature. That's the reason why a submarine can easily hide under certain cold layers of water. Let me drop.
WB-20, WW.
How we recognize the speed of sound in water changes so rapidly as a function of temperature that if you have certain layers of water temperature, it represents a kind of nearly perfect meter. A submarine can go under those layers of water and be thoroughly hidden. That has happened. As such, to protect from that situation, there are sonar-like ships that will drag a thing they call a fish. It's a below-water object dragged on a cable that's got hydrophones on it, so that you're doing the emitting below these layers of water at different temperatures in order to find that submarine. Telefonics manufactured that product, and they called it a fish, and it had a more technical name than that. So speed of sound in water or air is highly dependent on temperature and much, much less dependent on pressure. The higher temperature air molecules, water or air molecules, move faster. The speed of sound in that medium also moves faster, because it's the individual molecules carrying the energy of that sound wave by way of their average forward velocity, so to speak. That's my understanding of this one. Go ahead, Howie. HWW, K2IW.
Okay, Dick. want to make some observations here. This is for many years being on the low band, you know, running single sideband. Now, I'm listening, I'm doing a lot of listening on frequencies like 80 and 40. Two things I can say. One, and this has nothing to do with sunspot cycles, but you get on 80 meters and you have a snowstorm and you got a lot of snow out there, you know, just blanket snow and it's cold, your noise level is going to be lower and your propagation is going to be better. That means, let's say, in the middle of January or February, you're going to be able to talk to guys 200 or 300 miles away, either on 75 or 40 with very nice signals, low noise level. Now, you go to a hot day in the summertime, forget about, you know, lightning noise, and you're not going to have as much propagation. So, believe it or not, the signal is going to bounce along much better because of the snow. And some people think I'm crazy at saying that. Now, as far as the D-layer is concerned, I'll say this much. At nighttime, doing a low, you know, if you're a low-band operator, you're going to do most of your, you're going to operate 80 and 40 and 160 doing the, you know, the low peak of the sunspot cycle, and then want to operate the higher frequencies. And I also think that you generate noise, so that when you're in, when you have, you know, when you're at the peak of a sunspot cycle and you're in the middle of the day, I think the ionosphere is being, you know, excited at the D layer, and that's creating broadband noise, Dick. And it also distorts it, because I can tell you that you listen to a guy 25 miles away and you hear phase distortion. Also another reason why AM broadcast stations have to change their patterns and their power levels between daytime and nighttime, and even seasonable. I mean, stations have propagation charts that tell them that in the wintertime they're going to have better propagation than they are going to have in the summertime, especially for AM broadcast stations. Back to you, Dick.
Amazing. So if Howie's observations are accurate, and he's apparently done it quite a few times, on a snowy day, 80 meters has a lot better propagation at high noon. On a snowy day, the majority of that atmosphere, what water is there, is in frozen form. Water in frozen form is a very different substance than water in the liquid form. Obvious by the way it behaves in a microwave oven, and by what Howie is seeing on 80 meters. So water in liquid form maybe is part of the absorption, the ionization of that water in liquid form on a summer day at high noon, may be part of the mechanism of that D layer. I think it's absorptivity that's making the signal get dissipated. Roy believes that there's another factor going on with partial cancellation of reflection, of Nevis-like reflection. But isn't that something? I've never considered the water vapor in the D layer as being a factor. Water vapor in liquid form, in frozen form, in snow, is almost not there. Ain't that crazy? Assuming that what Roy just, how he just told us, isn't that different than we thought it was going to be, Roy? ACQGS, K2LIW?
Well, yes. I mean, I wasn't quite sure of the etiology of the interference, but it could very well be a phase distortion causing the interference. And, you know, I'm not saying that it's 50-50. It might be 87% pure attenuated absorption and 13% other factors, including the phasing and the reflective interference. But it's just one big soup. But I think the bottom moral of the story is not all propagation levels are good for us.
That was a triple. One at a time, you guys.
US2N.
K2J with one more thought. Okay, I heard Paul, Eric, and Wes in that order. Go ahead, Paul.
Coming this spring, we have a launch dedicated to the ionosphere. It's called ICON, and it will be launched around 350 miles above the surface. So they're going to study that ionosphere, you know, between the 50 miles and the 600 miles up. They're going to try to determine the effects of Earth weather, you know, coming down from below, and the solar weather above, and on how it all the affects the ionosphere. So you've got the thing that's going to be launched from Kwajalein Island on a Pegasus rocket. So I'm looking forward to that, but that will be springtime next year, and that might help answer some of these questions. That NASA admits it's very complicated. Patterns and all the different flows of the ionosphere up above, and they're trying to get a hold of it because they have a lot of communications that go through that's affected by it. Including their GPS to some degree. Back to
you. Run this by one more time now, Paul. This new satellite that NASA is going to launch is going to be looking at propagation, I guess, from the ground through the ionosphere to the satellite. Do you know what frequencies are going to be studied and what angles? I mean, are this going to be straight overhead, or is this grazing angles on the horizon? But what frequencies do you believe are going to be studied, Paul? Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sure it's going to be studying the ionosphere itself, the clouds of ionized winds. There's massive ionized winds that move across the globe. They want to track those locations, where it's traveling, and at what time of day, what time of year, how the weather from down below, affects the ionosphere, and how the space weather affects it. And they're going to keep track of this from not only month to month, but year to year, to try to get a handle on what's really energizing it, and which what's making it move which way and when. So it's going to be a complete study of the ionosphere. In fact, they call it the Ionosphere Connection Explorer, so it's called ICON. So we'll be talking about it in the spring. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, I now know that they're going to be observing the ionosphere. Are they observing it at radio frequencies, infrared frequencies, optical frequencies, ultraviolet frequencies? Is it a topside sounder? Is it a propagation sounder? They're looking at ionosphere, but how are they seeing the ionosphere? Is it a signal being transmitted through, reflected from above? That's a topside sounder. Are they looking at what frequency region are they doing this observation, if you happen to know? Over to you, Paul.
I don't know the instruments on board at all, really. Some kind of airflow type of thing. I really don't know what they have on board. But the goal is, if you go to their site, you'll see that they're trying to track the ionosphere itself. So they probably have some kind of detectors to detect where that ionosphere is. They call it air glow. That's the word that they use, air glow. So how they're going to visualize that or detect it, I don't know. I'll have to look into their detectors. Most of these things usually have half a dozen instruments on board. But we'll have to look into that as we go. But the good news is this thing's going to be studied in depth with a dedicated satellite launched by a Pegasus rocket that's going to be dropped from an L-1011 and then shot into space that way, 350 miles up. Still not sure exactly the inclination of this thing, what that's going to be either. Back to you, there.
You said some magic words there, Paul. Air glow. It does sound like it's optical ultraviolet. It's what it sounds like, is the method of observation. Eric, KE2EJ, go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I'm beginning to remember a little more stuff. When there is a solar event, we're not just talking about sunspot cycles, we're talking about an intense event, that those electrons and protons that are moving pretty rapidly create a literally a shockwave in the geomagnetic field of the Earth, where you have these areas of ionized gases, and it's constantly moving and wiggling and doing all sorts of stuff. I believe that causes a lot of phase effects. I think it's those effects are more prevalent in the high VHF leading into the microwave region, where it's more observable. But there's something that tells me, and what I'm trying to remember, that this shockwave has a really intense effect of how the plasmas in the atmospheres move and how it affects the absorption and reflection and diffraction of radio waves.
Solar wind coming off the sun is 1-3 million miles an hour. And depending on the coronal mass expulsion, CME, I think it's called coronal mass expulsion, you can get a tremendous number of these charged particles of solar wind coming off as a great big cloud, billions of pounds of this stuff, aimed at a million or a couple of million miles an hour at the Earth. That has all kinds of effects when it gets to our Van Allen belt, creates aurora borealis and australis and whatever. On top of that, the sun, during a number of its events, is also emitting lots of ultraviolet rays. Now, what's really creating the majority of the ionospheric effects? Is it the charged particles of the solar wind, the pure mass of them, their ionization, their charge? Or is it the ultraviolet rays creating ionization when those rays hit the ionosphere? Or is it some combination, 30 of one, 70 of the other? What's your guess on that, Eric, during a CME? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, I wish I was in front of a computer right now, but I could probably look this up. I think it's a combination of ingredients, so to speak, because you actually have the gases from the CME that's affecting not only the ionosphere and the atmosphere, but the magnetic fields themselves. The secondary effects from ultraviolet energy, from X-ray energy, and there's something else that's not on the tip of my tongue, but it affects the plasma that actually hits the Earth. Come on. I can't think of it right now. Sorry.
I'll bet you Roy has got some answers to all of this. Roy?
N2HGN.
Okay, yeah, I'm sorry about that. N2HGN, go ahead, Wes.
That's an interesting moment because I have a problem with a vapor delayer. The water vapor is pretty much present in the lower part that would be to absorb solar energy and thermal radiation from the planet's surface, and that would be troposphere. But as far as the altitude of 60 to 100 kilometers, which would be D layer, we are dealing with the light gases, which would be atomic oxygen, helium, and hydrogen over there. Also, what Eric said about ultraviolet and X-ray, photon cannot interact with the photon, as it's given, but it can ionize the particles of the air. Also, as far as the water, 99% of the water vapor is in the troposphere. So how much is left for the D layer?
Yeah, I'm going to turn this over to Roy very soon. He just brought in an interesting effect. The troposphere is the first 6 miles of the air above the Earth. It's usually defined as the troposphere. And that's where the majority of the water vapor, if there is water vapor, is going to be. But our D layer goes a lot many miles higher than that. And so an awful lot of the D layer is way above the troposphere, and where water vapor is probably a much, much less effect. So we're slowly convincing ourselves that water vapor is one of the mechanisms of absorption of the D layer. And if that's true, maybe it's only happening in the first 6 miles. So how much is water vapor affecting D layer absorption? And here we are with this observation that Howie is telling us about, that on a snowy day in the wintertime, at high noon, when under normal circumstances, at the peak of the, at a high portion of the sunspot cycle, at high noon, when in theory a lot of X-rays and whatever are hitting the ionosphere, the D layer is nowhere near as absorptive on a snowy day. Let's see what Eric said. Let's see what Roy's going to say about all of this. AC2GS, what's really creating all of this D layer non-propagation? AC2GS, K2RIW.
By the way, hydrogen ionization will affect S-band.
I accept that. Right now, we're talking about HF frequencies and what's really creating this. 80 meters at high noon, in many situations, seems to completely die. Over to you, Roy.
AC2GS. So, like they say about relationships on Facebook, it's complicated. As far as the CMEs, coronal mass ejections, everything including the kitchen sink is ejected. There are high energy photons of X-rays and gamma rays and such. There are alpha particles, there are beta particles that are traveling at near relativistic speed. There's all kinds of fun stuff that's going to bang into air molecules in the different layers and ionize them. And actually, historically, the A layer is the troposphere. They were naming layers before they kind of figured out where the ionosphere began. So A layer is the same thing as the troposphere. So is there some residual moisture effect that is interacting with the D layer possibly? It's, like I said, it's extremely complicated.
We're starting to hear more and more stories about what will mankind be exposed to as far as undesirable radiation is concerned when we take that good fraction of a year or multi-year trip to Mars. On the way to Mars, inside your spaceship, the astronauts are going to be bathed in all kinds of things coming from the sun. Yes, there's cosmic rays coming from the outside of the galaxy. But what the sun is going to be doing, because coronal mass expulsion that happens to be aimed at your spacecraft on the way to Mars, and you're there for a good fraction of a year, the human being is going to be absorbing a hell of a lot of ionizing radiation, radiation that's capable of changing the genetics of your cells of your body. So if the sun can do things that is going to change the health of the cells of your body inside of your spaceship, that ionizing radiation that a human being is going to be absorbing, and maybe the water vapor in the D layer and the troposphere has similar absorption characteristics. So I think we're slowly deriving some of the mechanisms by which the sun does all of these effects on humans in space and the D layer of our ionosphere. KC2GS, AC2GS, K2RIW. Yeah. Add any words to this, Roy, go ahead.
WDHWW.
Well, the problem is the space is not a very safe place, and we evolved on the Earth to do reasonably good on the Earth, and so you take us off the Earth and we start to get problems. So I'm sure engineers are working on it, and we'll continue to work on different ways of shielding us from all kinds of radiation pouring across in space. Whether they'll be able to do it in a foolproof manner or not is beyond me. But, I mean, you take something as simple as what you and Paul were discussing the other day about a sunburn of a cornea. I mean, that happens on the Earth. Can you imagine what a sunburn of your entire body would be like from the inside out?
Comment.
We've got Howie and Wes in that order. The ionizing effects. The articles that I've read so far say that they know of no good way of really protecting an astronaut on the way to Mars. On the Earth, we've got this huge magnetic field, Earth's magnetic field, that does a lot of deflection of cosmic rays and solar wind particles and whatever. We've got this ionosphere, we've got this atmosphere. We've got lots of protective mechanisms. We're underneath the Van Allen belt. So the magnetic field, the Van Allen belt, the layers of the ionosphere and the atmosphere give us a tremendous amount of multiple layers of protection to try to create. And these energy particles coming out of the sun and coming out of cosmic rays from space can extremely easily penetrate the side of the spacecraft, penetrate your body and go roaring right on through. The astronauts at nighttime, when they close their eyes, they see flashes of Cherenkov radiation, of the cosmic rays hitting the fluids in their eye, creating flashes of light. Astronauts are going to be exposed to that. And to try to create enough mass and enough magnetic field to absorb and deflect all of that is going to be very difficult. Let's see, who was it that just signed in? Howie was the first one. WB2HWW? K2IW. Go ahead, Howie.
Okay, two things I want to make a comment. I think some of the action you're seeing is ground wave action, how the signal travels along the Earth on 80 and 40 as far as it being cold. Now, I'm going to say this. You will notice this more at night. You'll notice this in the middle of the day, like 2, 3 o'clock, and if you got a cold day, you might get a little bit better propagation, or I'll notice that some of the AM broadcast stations will be a little stronger. This is back when I was doing a lot of AM listening back in the 60s and the 70s. Now, what I want to make clear is that you notice this more at night, that on a snowy, cold night, let's say 20, 25 degrees out, at night between, let's say, 5 to 10 o'clock at night, you're going to hear very strong signals on 160 and very strong signals on 80, and you're going to have much better signals. I think that's partly to the fact that you have a lower noise floor. So you notice this at night. So the D-layer has gone away at that point, Dick. But what I'm trying to say, I think some of it is due to propagation. And I've also noticed this. Say you're on 15 meters or even 10 meters, and it's you got a good snowy day, working double hops is usually going to be better because I think the signals bounce off the Earth off of snow easier than if there was no snow at that particular place. And I'm talking about double hop F-skip. K2RIW, WDTH, WDM. Just trying to make it clear that a lot of what I observed was at night, that when you have snow at night, when it's not snowing, I'm talking about after the snow, when it's snowing, when the actual snow is coming down, that does not do good stuff for propagation. But when you have a cold day, snow on the ground, at night, you're going to have it. And then, especially at 2, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you're going to have better signals. Right around 12 o'clock, you're going to have very poor propagation. But as you start to go, as the sun starts to go down at an angle, you're going to have, that's when you get your 200 or 300 mile propagation. And especially in the morning, especially on 40 or 80, that's when you can talk to your friends within a couple hundred miles. K2RIW, WB2HWW.
Howie, I've got a quick question for you, Howie. I hope you remember, what does your S-meter look like on 80 meters on these various conditions? Wintertime, summertime, high humidity day, snowy day. What's the highest you've ever seen your 80-meter S-meter when no signal is present? The noise on 80 meters. What's the highest and lowest you've ever seen your S-meter? Was it ever as high as S9 or above? Was it ever as low as S3 and below? That's my first question now, Howie. WB2HWW, K2RIW. I'm going to make a point with this one.
Oh, yeah. I can tell you from remembering, like, if you had a good cold day at 2, 3 o'clock, if you could find a quiet spot on 80 meters, be about S1 or S2, S3. And then in the summertime, in the middle of the summertime, you could see an S9 noise level, especially on 80 meters. Now, I'm going to make another comment. That's why you go to a higher frequency, because as you go up in frequency, if you go from 80 meters to 40 meters, you actually see that 6 dB drop. You see the noise level going down. Then you get to 20 meters, you get to 15. When you get to 10 meters, you have an S0 noise level. You got to start running a preamp, obviously, because you need to get more gain in the front end of your receiver. But as you go from 80 meters, you go to 40, you see a less noise level. As you go to 20, 15, and 10. So you wouldn't want to use 80 meters for local communications in the middle of the day, because especially the noise levels. I see noise levels as high as S9, 10 over 9, especially on 80 meters. Some of that could be due to a sun, from a thunderstorm, and some of that is due just to the atmospheric noise, just random noise in the atmosphere.
Yeah, there are millions of solar, there are millions of lightning strikes taking place somewhere around the world continuously. Every second has got millions of lightning strikes to it, or a thunderstorm somewhere in the world. That's the good news. That's one factor. However, if the 80-meter propagation is such that you can just barely hear the guy 10 miles away or 5 miles away because of so much delay or absorption at high noon, those lightning strikes, millions of them, although they're taking place all over the world, they're all way outside of your listening region as I see it. They're not the factor. There's some other mechanism of noise being generated at high noon on a summer day, giving you that S9 noise. That's the main reason why you see this peculiar effect that I'm about to describe. Let me drop. Lots of people have asked the question. I just got a brand new rig. I don't have an antenna yet, but I took this clip lead that's 5 feet long, and I connected it to the center conductor of the UHF connector on the back end of my rig. And I'm listening to the 80-meter band. I tune across the 80-meter band, and I hear a whole bunch of sideband signals. They sound beautiful. I don't get very much S-meter deflection from them, but they sound beautiful. I'm hearing a whole bunch of guys. That antenna, that clip lead, is 0.1 wavelength long, or 0.05 wavelength long. It's got a standing wave ratio of 1,000 to 1. It's extremely impedance mismatched. Yet I'm hearing very good signals from it. I eventually get a good dipole. I put it up 60 feet in the air, a full 80-meter dipole, 131 feet long, and I hear the exact same guys. I get a lot more S-meter signal strength out of them, but they sound the same. When I finally put up that 80-meter dipole, I flip back and forth between that clip lead and the real antenna. On the real antenna, the guy is 20 over 9. On the clip lead, the guy is S6. But he sounds equally good in both conditions. How can he sound that good when he's that much weaker? And one of the answers is that the noise figure on 80 meters can easily be equivalent to a 40 decibel noise figure, so-called low noise front end that's in failure mode. Let me drop. Your first amplifier could be an extremely noisy transistor. On 80 meters, you might not know the difference because the amount of noise coming into your antenna, even if it's a really bad antenna, that clip lead is giving you a signal strength that's 20 or 30 decibels weaker than the real antenna. But because the noise figure is 40 dB above KTB, so to speak, the automatic gain control of your receiver adjusts itself until the noise of the band coming in the antenna is normalized, and now the signal-to-noise ratio is all that counts. When you've got that much noise coming into whichever antenna, the good antenna is 25 dB more noise and 25 dB more signal. Same signal-to-noise ratio. So on 80 meters, a really yucky antenna, as a quick test, can work very well. You can't transmit through that clip lead. Nobody's going to hear you. And you're going to arc it over, and your rig is going to be very unhappy with that visor. You can't transmit into it. but you can receive. You do that same trick on 2 meters. Oh boy, you need a real antenna. So the noise of the band, the noise coming into the 80-meter frequency region, and I think a D-layer noise is what we're slowly deriving, makes a big factor that makes that yucky antenna work well enough. AC2GS, K2RW, go ahead, Roy.
AC2GS. Well, I mean, it's well known that the noise in the lower frequencies are external and the noises that we pick up on the higher frequencies are more internally generated in the radio. And that's why we use a preamp on the higher frequencies. You wouldn't think of using a preamp on 80 meters because with every dB increase of the signal, you increase the noise just as much and the signal-to-noise ratio remains the same. So, yeah, that's the way it works.
You add a preamp on 80 meters, you just create the high-level signal overload. Who's the person who just said something, Dick? Go right ahead. Give us your full call, name, and then proceed.
It's me, Dick, and it's a wheel. That's the reason why roof antennas are very good on 160, 80, and 40 for receiving. My radio, which is a TS-590SG Kenwood, has two antennas, two antenna capability. One for receiving only, where you can plug in a loop, and a regular antenna for transmitting like 100 watts. That would be on a dipole.
So if somebody loans you or you've just received a rig, as I remember delivering a transmitter to a transceiver to a guy about a year ago, and he didn't have an antenna on the QTH that he was at the time. So we just connected a piece of wire, a random piece of wire to the center conductor of the UHF connector on this 80 through 10 meter sideband rig. I started listening to the HF band, and they sounded beautiful. You can't transmit into that thing, but you can receive through it. I think we've slowly derived some of the characteristics of the D layer.
One more comment.
Go ahead, Wes.
I was mentioning in my previous comment that there is no water vapor left for the D layer. We're talking about few parts per million of the water vapor in the D layer. So 99% would be in stratosphere. The lower stratosphere will take probably another less than 1%. So for the D layer, which is, say, at the maximum of 100 kilometers, nothing left. So I exclude that factor. But you were talking about what would happen if we don't have all of those layers protection. Let me jump.
Hold on now. How come Howie sees such a huge difference on a snowy day versus a non-snowy day if you think water vapor is so little of a factor on D layer? Over to you, Wes.
Probably that's what you said, and the wording of yours was, well, maybe the D layer is absorbed at the first 6 miles. But the D layer starts from 35 kilometers up. That's where it starts. It doesn't start from 6 miles. So I assume that you were talking about whatever the D layer was supposed to do, the stratosphere is on the top of it. But if that is complicated, maybe Dr. Roy could translate me and to explain it.
Okay, you're saying water vapor is not a factor. Howie is giving us real hard evidence that it's a great big factor. Yes, even though the D layer starts at 35 kilometers and goes up from there, still that signal has to start at 50 feet off the ground where his antenna is, or 20 feet off the ground. It's got to get through that troposphere with that water vapor, with those snowflakes, before it gets into the D layer. So from my point of view, that troposphere is virtually part of the D layer. Maybe Roy's got a different opinion on this. AC2GS, K2LAW, go ahead, Roy.
AC2GS. I get the idea from what Howie said that he tends to believe this is more of a ground wave phenomena than a D layer phenomena, because it's just as pronounced in the middle of the night when the D layer is completely dissipated. So, you know, we might be quibbling over some things, but this isn't necessarily related to the D layer. It could be some other phenomena.
The D layer starts from 35 to 55 miles. So what are we talking about, 6 miles?
The word ground wave implies that Howie is talking about how much signal reflects off of the Earth on that multiple bounce signal, so to speak. When you're down at 80 meters, at normal soil characteristics, the depth of penetration of that 80-meter signal into the soil, I don't know what it is, but I'm going to make a guess. It might be a meter of, in other words, that signal bouncing off the Earth cares what the soil looks like for the first 3 feet of soil, the first meter of soil. Those snowflakes that are sitting on top of that soil, that's an extremely minor factor. Because Howie is not describing this during a blizzard. He's just talking about some snowflakes. So the reflectivity of the ground versus snowflakes without snowflakes affecting ground wave, I'm having trouble with that one. You see where I'm going with that one, Roy? AC2GS, K2LAW.
WB2HWW. Dick, just remember that I'm talking about when you have 3 to 4 inches of snow on the ground. You know, I'm talking about 50, 60 miles away from the city out in the hinterlands. That's where you have a sheet of snow, Dick. I'm talking about when you have 3 to 5 inches of snow, not just a couple snowflakes.
Okay, the band is getting quiet on that snowy day. Are you telling me that the noise that you normally have on 80 meters is coming from the ground, and now with snow on the ground, we don't hear the noise of the ground anymore? I'm having trouble with that one, Howie. WB2HWW, K2LAW.
What I'm saying, Dick, is this. There may be mechanical noise, there may be man-made noise, but as you get colder, the molecules are not moving as much. Okay? I don't know if the noise is being generated 35 miles up or being generated at 10,000 feet, but all I can tell you is the noise level does get quieter in the wintertime, does get quieter when the temperatures are colder, and after a snowstorm, you're going to find out that if you're listening, all I can give you is observations. If I'm listening to, let's say, W3 out of, let's say, you know, central Pennsylvania, or I'm listening to, let's say, W1 up in Vermont, or I'm even listening to shortwave radio, listening to WBCQ out of Monticello, Maine, and I'm listening to a bunch of guys on 40 or 80 at night when you have a good snowstorm, after a good snowstorm, and you got snow on the ground, the signals are stronger. You see less phase distortion, and the span seems to be much more stable. But I will tell you that lately, if you speak to a lot of guys on the low band, they tell you the bands are in crazy shape, Dick. What I'm trying to get at is this. I think there's a lot more that's going on 80 meters that has to do with more closer to the Earth than what you're talking about at the D layer.
You said that temperature is making a change in the noise. I'm going to agree, but now we've got a magnitude problem. If I've got a 50-ohm resistor sitting on the table, and I measure the noise power coming out of that resistor, it's not proportional to temperature in degrees centigrade or Fahrenheit, it's degrees Kelvin. Room temperature of that resistor is sitting at 290 Kelvin. If I put it in a freezer, and I lower its temperature 15 degrees Kelvin, 15 degrees centigrade, we're down to 275 Kelvin. That's still a big number. The, the noise of 275 Kelvin versus 290 Kelvin, that's not a big ratio. Even though to you and me, that 15 degrees centigrade is a big temperature difference. You're going to put on a coat, if you know what I mean. So that doesn't affect, that doesn't explain an S9 noise versus an S2 noise. There's something else going on here. Pure temperature of the snow, the earth, and the ionosphere, and the D layer. I'm having trouble accepting temperature as being the factor.